that in Aleppo once. Dear V, among other things, this is to tell you that at last I am here, in the country whither so many sunsets have led. One of the first persons I saw was our good old Gleb Alexandrovich Gecko, gloomily crossing Columbus Avenue in quest of the Petit Café du Coin, which none of us three will ever visit again. He seemed to think that somehow or other you were betraying our national literature, and he gave me your address with a deprecatory shake of his gray head, as if you did not deserve the treat of hearing from me. I have a story for you, which reminds me, I mean, putting it like this reminds me, of the days when we wrote our first utter warm bubbling verse, and all things, a rose, a puddle, a lighted window, cried out to us, "I'm a rhyme." Yes, this is a most useful universe. We play, we die. Ig rhyme, umi rhyme. And the sonorous souls of Russian verbs lend a meaning to the wild gesticulation of trees, or to some discarded newspaper sliding and pausing and shuffling again, with abortive flaps and apterous jerks along an endless windswept embankment. But just now I am not a poet. I come to you like that gushing lady in Chekhov, who was dying to be described. I married, let me see, about a month after you left France, and a few weeks before the gentle Germans roared into Paris. Although I can produce documentary proofs of matrimony, I am positive now that my wife never existed. You may know her name from some other source, but that does not matter. It is the name of an illusion. Therefore, I am able to speak of her with as much detachment as I would of a character in a story, one of your stories, to be precise. It was love at first touch rather than at first sight, for I had met her several times before without experiencing any special emotions. But one night, as I was seeing her home, something quaint she had said made me stoop with a laugh and lightly kiss her on the hair. And of course we all know of that blinding blast which is caused by merely picking up a small doll from the floor of a carefully abandoned house. The soldier involved hears nothing. For him it is but an ecstatic, soundless and boundless expansion of what had been during his life a pinpoint of light in the dark center of his being. And really, the reason we think of death in celestial terms is that the visible firmament, especially at night, above our blacked-out Paris with the gaunt arches of its boulevard Exelmans and the ceaseless alpine gurgle of desolate latrines, is the most adequate and ever-present symbol of that vast silent explosion. But I cannot discern her. She remains as nebulous as my best poem, the one you made such gruesome fun of in the Literaturnia Zapiski. When I want to imagine her, I have to cling mentally to a tiny brown birthmark on her downy forearm, as one concentrates upon a punctuation mark in an illegible sentence. Perhaps, had she used a greater amount of makeup or used it more constantly, I might have visualized her face today, or at least the delicate transverse furrows of dry, hot, rouged lips. But I fail, although I still feel their elusive touch now and then in the blind man's buff of my senses, in that sobbing sort of dream when she and I clumsily clutch at each other through a heartbreaking mist, and I cannot see the color of her eyes, for the blank luster of brimming tears drowning their irises. She was much younger than I. Not as much younger as was Natalie of the lovely bare shoulders and long earrings in relation to swarthy Pushkin, but still there was a sufficient margin for that kind of retrospective romanticism which finds pleasure in imitating the destiny of a unique genius, down to the jealousy, down to the filth, down to the stab of seeing her almond-shaped eyes turn to her blonde Cassio behind her peacock-feathered fan, even if one cannot imitate his verse. She liked mine, though, and would scarcely have yawned as the other was wont to do every time her husband's poem happened to exceed the length of a sonnet. If she has remained a phantom to me, I may have been one to her. I suppose she had been solely attracted by the obscurity of my poetry, then tore a hole through its veil and saw a stranger's unlovable face. As you know, I had been for some time planning to follow the example of your fortunate flight. She described to me an uncle of hers who lived, she said, in New York. He had taught riding at a southern college and wound up by marrying a wealthy American woman. They had a little daughter, born deaf. She said she had lost their address long ago, but a few days later it miraculously turned up, and we wrote a dramatic letter to which we never received any reply. This did not much matter, as I had already obtained a sound affidavit from Professor Lomchenko of Chicago, but little else had been done in the way of getting the necessary papers when the invasion began, whereas I foresaw that if we stayed on in Paris, some helpful compatriot of mine would sooner or later point out to the interested party sundry passages in one of my books where I argued that, with all her many black sins, Germany was still bound to remain forever and ever the laughingstock of the world. So we started upon our disastrous honeymoon, crushed and jolted amid the apocalyptic exodus, waiting for unscheduled trains that were bound for unknown destinations, walking through the stale stage setting of abstract towns, living in a permanent twilight of physical exhaustion. We fled, and the farther we fled, the clearer it became that what was driving us on was something more than a booted and buckled fool with his assortment of variously propelled junk, something of which he was a mere symbol, something monstrous and impalpable, a timeless and faceless mass of immemorial horror that still keeps coming at me from behind, even here, in the green vacuum of Central Park. Oh, she bore it gamely enough, with a kind of dazed cheerfulness. Once, however, quite suddenly, she started to sob in a sympathetic railway carriage. "The dog," she said, "the dog we left. I cannot forget the poor dog." And the honesty of her grief shocked me, as we had never had any dog. "I know," she said, "but I tried to imagine we had actually bought that setter. And just think, he would be now whining behind a locked door." There had never been any talk of buying a setter. I should also not like to forget a certain stretch of high road and the sight of a family of refugees, two women, a child, whose old father or grandfather had died on the way. The sky was a chaos of black and flesh-colored clouds with an ugly sunburst beyond a hooded hill, and the dead man was lying on his back under a dusty plane tree. With a stick in their hands, the woman had tried to dig a roadside grave. But the soil was too hard. They had given it up and were sitting side by side among the anemic poppies, a little apart from the corpse and its upturned beard. But the little boy was still scratching and scraping and tugging until he tumbled a flat stone and forgot the object of his solemn exertions as he crouched on his haunches, his thin, eloquent neck showing all its vertebrae to the headsman, and watched with surprise and delight thousands of minute brown ants, seething, zigzagging, dispersing, heading for places of safety in the Gard and the Aude and the Drôme and the Var and the Basse-Pyrénées. We two paused only in Po. Spain proved too difficult, and we decided to move on to Nice. At a place called Fougères, a 10-minute stop, I squeezed out of the train to buy some food. When a couple of minutes later I came back, the train was gone, and the muddled old man responsible for the atrocious void that faced me, coal dust glittering in the heat between naked indifferent rails and a lone piece of orange peel, brutally told me that, anyway, I had had no right to get out. In a better world, I could have had my wife located and told what to do. I had both tickets and most of the money. As it was, my nightmare struggle with the telephone proved futile. So I dismissed the whole series of diminutive voices barking at me from afar, sent two or three telegrams, which are probably on their way only now, and late in the evening took the next local to Montpellier, farther than which her train would not stumble. Not finding her there, I had to choose between two alternatives, going on because she might have boarded the Marseille train, which I had just missed, or going back because she might have returned to Fougères. I forget now what tangle of reasoning led me to Marseille and Nice. Beyond such routine action as forwarding false data to a few unlikely places, the police did nothing to help. One man bellowed at me for being a nuisance, another sidetracked the question by doubting the authenticity of my marriage certificate, because it was stamped on what he contended to be the wrong side. A third, a fat commissaire with liquid brown eyes, confessed that he wrote poetry in his spare time. I looked up various acquaintances among the numerous Russians domiciled or stranded in Nice. I heard those among them who chanced to have Jewish blood talk of their doomed kinsmen, crammed into hell-bound trains. And my own plight, by contrast, acquired a commonplace air of irreality, while I sat in some crowded café with the milky blue sea in front of me, and a shell-hollow murmur behind, telling and retelling the tale of massacre and misery, and the grey paradise beyond the ocean, and the ways and whims of harsh consuls. A week after my arrival, an indolent plainclothesman called upon me and took me down a crooked and smelly street to a black-stained house with the word hotel, almost erased by dirt and time. There, he said, my wife had been found. The girl he produced was an absolute stranger, of course, but my friend Holmes kept on trying for some time to make her and me confess we were married, while her taciturn and muscular bedfellow stood by and listened, his bare arms crossed on his striped chest. When at length I got rid of those people and had wandered back to my neighborhood, I happened to pass by a compact queue waiting at the entrance of a food store, and there, at the very end, was my wife, straining on tiptoe to catch a glimpse of what exactly was being sold. I think the first thing she said to me was that she hoped it was oranges. Her tale seemed a trifle hazy, but perfectly banal. She had returned to Faugères and gone straight to the commissariat instead of making inquiries at the station, where I had left a message for her. A party of refugees suggested that she join them. She spent the night in a bicycle shop with no bicycles, on the floor, together with three elderly women who lay, she said, like three logs in a row. Next day she realized that she had not enough money to reach Nice. Eventually she borrowed some from one of the log women. She got into the wrong train, however, and traveled to a town the name of which she could not remember. She had arrived at Nice 2 days ago and found some friends at the Russian church. They had told her I was somewhere around, looking for her, and would surely turn up soon. Sometime later, as I sat on the edge of the only chair in my garret and held her by her slender young hips, she was combing her soft hair and tossing her head back with every stroke, her dim smile changed all at once into an odd quiver, and she placed one hand on my shoulder, staring down at me as if I were a reflection in a pool, which she had noticed for the first time. "I've been lying to you, dear," she said. "Ya Igunya. I stayed for several nights in Montpellier with a brute of a man I met on the train. I did not want it at all. He sold hair lotions." The time, the place, the torture, her fan, her gloves, her mask. I spent that night and many others getting it out of her bit by bit, but not getting it all. I was under the strange delusion that first I must find out every detail, reconstruct every minute, and only then decide whether I could bear it. But the limit of desired knowledge was unattainable, nor could I ever foretell the approximate point after which I might imagine myself satiated, because, of course, the denominator of every fraction of knowledge was potentially as infinite as the number of intervals between the fractions themselves. Oh, the first time she had been too tired to mind, and the next had not minded because she was sure I had deserted her, and she apparently considered that such explanations ought to be a kind of consolation prize for me, instead of the nonsense and agony they really were. It went on like that for eons, she breaking down every now and then, but soon rallying again, answering my unprintable questions in a breathless whisper, or trying with a pitiful smile to wriggle into the semi-security of irrelevant commentaries, and I crushing and crushing the mad molar till my jaw almost burst with pain, a flaming pain which seemed somehow preferable to the dull, humming ache of humble endurance. And mark, in between the periods of this inquest, we were trying to get from reluctant authorities certain papers which, in their turn, would make it lawful to apply for a third kind, which would serve as a stepping stone toward a permit enabling the holder to apply for yet other papers which might or might not give him the means of discovering how and why it had happened. For even if I could imagine the accursed, recurrent scene, I failed to link up its sharp-angled grotesque shadows with the dim limbs of my wife as she shook and rattled and dissolved in my violent grasp. So nothing remained but to torture each other, to wait for hours on end in the prefecture, filling forms, conferring with friends who had already probed the innermost viscera of all visas, pleading with secretaries and filling forms again, with the result that her lusty and versatile traveling salesman became blended in a ghastly mix-up with rat-whiskered snarling officials, rotting bundles of obsolete records, the reek of violet ink, bribes slipped under gangrenous blotting paper, fat flies tickling moist necks with their rapid cold padded feet, new-laid clumsy concave photographs of your six subhuman doubles, the tragic eyes and patient politeness of petitioners born in Slutsk, Starodub, or Bobrisk, the funnels and pulleys of the Holy Inquisition, the awful smile of the bald man with the glasses who had been told that his passport could not be found. I confess that one evening, after a particularly abominable day, I sank down on a stone bench, weeping and cursing a mock world where millions of lives were being juggled by the clammy hands of consuls and commissaires. I noticed she was crying, too, and then I told her that nothing would really have mattered the way it mattered now, had she not gone and done what she did. "You will think me crazy," she said with a vehemence that for a second almost made a real person of her, "but I didn't. I swear that I didn't. Perhaps I lived several lives at once. Perhaps I wanted to test you. Perhaps this bench is a dream and we are in Saratov or on some star." It would be tedious to niggle the different stages through which I passed before accepting finally the first version of her delay. I did not talk to her, and was a good deal alone. She would glimmer and fade and reappear with some trifle she thought I would appreciate, a handful of cherries, three precious cigarettes, or the like, treating me with the unruffled mute sweetness of a nurse that trips from and to a gruff convalescent. I ceased visiting most of our mutual friends, because they had lost all interest in my passport affairs and seemed to have turned vaguely inimical. I composed several poems. I drank all the wine I could get. I clasped her one day to my groaning breast, and we went for a week to Kabul and lay on the round pink pebbles of the narrow beach. Strange to say, the happier our new relations seemed, the stronger I felt an undercurrent of poignant sadness. But I kept telling myself that this was an intrinsic feature of all true bliss. In the meantime, something had shifted in the moving pattern of our fates, and at last I emerged from a dark and hot office with a couple of plump visas de sortie cupped in my trembling hands. Into these the USA serum was duly injected, and I dashed to Marseille and managed to get tickets for the very next boat. I returned and tramped up the stairs. I saw a rose in a glass on the table, the sugar pink of its obvious beauty, the parasitic air bubbles clinging to its stem. Her two spare dresses were gone. Her comb was gone. Her checkered coat was gone, and so was the mauve hairband with a mauve bow that had been her hat. There was no note pinned to the pillow, nothing at all in the room to enlighten me, for of course the rose was merely what French rhymesters call une cheville. I went to the Veretiennikovs, who could tell me nothing, to the Hellmans, who refused to say anything, and to the Elyagins, who were not sure whether to tell me or not. Finally, the old lady, and you know what Anna Vladimirovna is like at crucial moments, asked for her rubber-tipped cane, heavily but energetically dislodged her bulk from her favorite armchair, and took me into the garden. There she informed me that, being twice my age, she had the right to say, "I was a bully and a cad." You must imagine the scene. The tiny graveled garden with its blue Arabian Nights jar and solitary cypress, the cracked terrace where the old lady's father had dozed with a rug on his knees when he'd retired from his Novgorod governorship to spend a few last evenings in Nice, the pale green sky, a whiff of vanilla in the deepening dusk, the crickets emitting their metallic trill pitched to two octaves above middle C, and Anna Vladimirovna, the folds of her cheeks jerkily dangling as she flung at me a motherly but quite undeserved insult. During several preceding weeks, my dear V, every time she had visited by herself the three or four families we both knew, my ghostly wife had filled the eager ears of all those kind people with an extraordinary story. To wit, that she had madly fallen in love with a young Frenchman who could give her a turreted home and a crested name, that she had implored me for a divorce and I had refused, that in fact I had said I would rather shoot her and myself than sail to New York alone, that she had said her father in a similar case had acted like a gentleman, that I had answered I did not give a hoot for her cocu de père. There were loads of other preposterous details of the kind, but they all hung together in such a remarkable fashion that no wonder the old lady made me swear I would not seek to pursue the lovers with a cocked pistol. They had gone, she said, to a chateau in Lozère. I inquired whether she had ever set eyes upon the man. No, but she had been shown his picture. As I was about to leave, Anna Vladimirovna, who had slightly relaxed and had even given me her five fingers to kiss, suddenly flared up again, struck the gravel with her cane, and said in her deep, strong voice, "But one thing I shall never forgive you. Her dog, that poor beast which you hanged with your own hands before leaving Paris." Whether the gentleman of leisure had changed into a traveling salesman, or whether the metamorphosis had been reversed, or whether again he was neither the one nor the other, but the nondescript Russian who had courted her before our marriage, all this was absolutely inessential. She had gone. That was the end. I should have been a fool had I begun the nightmare business of searching and waiting for her all over again. On the fourth morning of a long and dismal sea voyage, I met on the deck a solemn but pleasant old doctor with whom I had played chess in Paris. He asked me whether my wife was very much incommoded by the rough seas. I answered that I had sailed alone, whereupon he looked taken aback, and then said he had seen her a couple of days before going on board, namely in Marseille, walking rather aimlessly, he thought, along the embankment. She said that I would presently join her with bag and tickets. This is, I gathered, the point of the whole story, although if you write it you had better not make him a doctor, as that kind of thing has been overdone. It was at that moment that I suddenly knew for certain that she had never existed at all. I shall tell you another thing. When I arrived, I hastened to satisfy a certain morbid curiosity. I went to the address she had given me once. It proved to be an anonymous gap between two office buildings. I looked for her uncle's name in the directory. It was not there. I made some inquiries, and Gecko, who knows everything, informed me that the man and his horsey wife existed all right, but had moved to San Francisco after their deaf little girl had died. Viewing the past graphically, I see our mangled romance engulfed in a deep valley of mist between the crags of two matter-of-fact mountains. Life had been real before. Life will be real from now on, I hope. Not tomorrow, though. Perhaps after tomorrow. You, happy mortal, with your lovely family, how is Inez? How are the twins? And your diversified work, how are the lichens? Can hardly be expected to puzzle out my misfortune in terms of human communion, but you may clarify things for me through the prism of your art. Yet the pity of it. Curse your art. I am hideously unhappy. She keeps on walking to and fro where the brown nets are spread to dry on the hot stone slabs, and the dappled light of the water plays on the side of a moored fishing boat. Somewhere, somehow, I have made some fatal mistake. There are tiny pale bits of broken fish scales glistening here and there in the brown meshes. It may all end in Aleppo, if I am not careful. Spare me, V. You would load your dice with an unbearable implication if you took that for a title.